invite Mr. Mark McDonald to come forward briefly to explain perhaps some of this terminology, and two gentlemen from the Attorney General's office, if you would come up also. I was just having a side conversation here with Senator Bryant, and we'd appreciate perhaps Mr. McDonald, if you could briefly explain what the rationale is of this particular language. We had talked about a similar amendment yesterday, but this language is a little bit more detailed.
First of all, for the record, my name is Mark McDonald. I am a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. I think you know, most of you know who I am. I apologize that I'm not in tie today, but I'm here on my own vacation, so I didn't think under those circumstances it was necessary for me to wear a tie today.
No problem.
The purpose of the Dash 18 amendments essentially to replace the substance of the material there with what had been in HJR 91, the major difference being is that the federal rules for search and seizure would only apply to in cases involving a victim. It's my experience running the drug unit for Multnomah County, over 50% of our criminal cases are cases that do not involve a victim. So this would actually probably apply to a minority of the criminal cases in the state. We think that it's important for that reason because, to be quite frank, Oregon has a quite different rules in seizure, search and seizure than the vast majority of the jurisdictions in the country, and extend rights to individuals that are not afforded to similarly situated individuals in other states. We think it's important to balance that against the rights of victims and cases where there are a victim, that it would not really change the rules of under the Oregon Constitution for search and seizure, but would change the remedy, that the evidence would not be excluded if it was otherwise admissible under the Fourth Amendment.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Any questions for Mr. McDonald? All right. Gentleman from the Attorney General's office, would you like to offer some comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm special counsel to Attorney General Hardy Myers. Mr. McDonald is responsible in part for me being here since he was one of the persons who got me my first job at the Marion County District Attorney's Office. I have often seen him without a necktie, so that part of his testimony I dispute. Mr. Chair, we have worked since noon with Mr. McDonald on the draft that I think now takes form in the Dash B18 version. We do have some concerns, and Mr. Sylvester is here from our office to explain the most significant. Let me simply offer two other observations about the one unique to the B18 amendment and another that would apply as well to the document I've labeled DOJ Alternative, which is a crude, hand-engrossed version that the committee may wish to evaluate in its deliberations at some point. The first observation is that the Dash B18 amendments would not on their face apply to juvenile delinquency proceedings. The DOJ Alternative, I believe, would, and if that's the aim of the committee, if it's the aim of the committee to apply these to juvenile delinquency proceedings, then at least that needs to be addressed in some fashion. Secondly, both the DOJ alternative with the hand-engrossed additions and the B18 amendments are subject to a potential workability issue. And frankly, I haven't fully worked through this for myself, but I'm thinking of it in terms of the case that I handled when I was in Marion County as the drug prosecution deputy, in which the officers executed a search warrant looking for drugs. And in the course of the execution of the warrant, one of the officers was shot by the occupants of the house. Now that resulted in, fortunately the officer did not die, but it resulted in an indictment that had a combination of a non-victim offense, possession of the narcotics, and a victim offense, the intent to murder the officer. As I say, my thoughts on this are not fully formed, but it seems to me some attention needs to be paid to how a court would work through an indictment that had both those charges in the same indictment if some of the evidence would be subject to suppression under the rules applicable to offenses involving victims, and some would not be admissible under the, or would rather be admissible under the rules applying to offenses not involving victims. I don't know quite how those shake out, but it seems to me it's worth thinking through those issues in the context of the concept of these amendments. Ms. Sylvester is here from our appellate division to speak to the principal difference between HGR 91, the DOJ alternative, and the B-18 amendments.
Thank you. Chairman Mannix, members of the committee, Tim Sylvester, Department of Justice, appellate division. When the original form of HGR 91 was written in language that we called a lockstep that attempted to tie the substantive scope of Article 1, Section 9 to the Fourth Amendment. And the testimony we gave before the Senate Judiciary Committee on that, we explained that that opened up a potential challenge to the measure if it was adopted by the people under the revision clause of the Oregon Constitution. And we noted that the Supreme Court of the State of California interpreting a similar provision that was enacted by initiative in California, according to lockstep, the substantive scope of a state constitutional provision to a federal constitutional provision, the California Supreme Court struck that down on the ground that it was a revision of the Constitution that had not been enacted in the proper way. We don't necessarily agree with that decision by the California Supreme Court, and there may be a basis to distinguish that decision from what is going on here, but nonetheless, we express the concern that a lockstep provision could run afoul of the same challenge under Article 17 of the Oregon Constitution. So we proposed a slight modification that instead of tying the substantive scope of the state of Article 1, Section 9 to the Fourth Amendment merely eliminated the exclusionary rule under the Article 1, Section 9 and left, as it necessarily would have to, the exclusionary remedy under the Fourth Amendment as the floor there. And that was what ultimately became HGR 91. The present proposal, 89B18, I think may still have the same particular problem that of presenting a problem under the revision clause, although it's not entirely clear given the way it's written. Subsection 1 appears to tie the substantive scope of Article 1, Section 9, or the various Bill of Rights under the Oregon Constitution to the substantive scope of the federal Constitution. And that is true because the Oregon Supreme Court repeatedly has said that the exclusionary rule under the Article 1, Section 9 is part of the right granted by Article 1, Section 9. It's not a mere remedy, it's part of the right granted. And so what this appears to do is to tie the remedy under Article 1, Section 9, which is part of the right granted, to the Fourth Amendment, which again raises that revision clause problem. And so what we were proposing here, because I think the purpose of this proposal, 89B18, is simply to eliminate the exclusionary rule in criminal prosecutions for purpose of criminal prosecutions involving a victim. And I think the same thing can be done by a slight modification of HGR 91, and that is the engrossed version that you have before you, and adding the language in the prosecution of a crime involving a victim, then providing evidence relevant to the guilt of the criminal defendant shall not be excluded. And so what this effectively does is simply eliminates the exclusionary rule under Article 1, Section 9 in criminal prosecutions involving personal victims. And I think that, as I understand it, would not present any problem under the revision clause.
Mr. Sylvester, let me ask you. Some of us don't like the language in HGR 91 being engrossed because it's stated in a negative. looking at what you're suggesting as what ought to be accomplished, it seems to me that we could use language that would say, in the prosecution of a crime involving a victim in state court, I'm playing with this right now, evidence that would be admissible in a criminal case under the United States Constitution is admissible, something along those lines, instead of saying shall not be excluded. How does that work?
Well, I think you still have the same problem, and that is it. Although I could argue strenuously to the contrary, and if this gets enacted in its present form, I will probably end up having to try to defend it to the extent possible. I do see the problem, though, that you're still attempting to tie the substantive scope of Article 1, Section 9 to the Fourth Amendment.
How about this, Mr. Sylvester? Mm-hmm. Evidence that would be admissible in a criminal case under the United States Constitution shall not be excluded as to any Oregon constitutional provision. I'm just playing with this a little
bit. Chairman Mannix, another possibility is to say in the prosecution of a crime involving a victim, evidence relevant to the guilt of a criminal defendant or a proper sentence is admissible, notwithstanding that it was not obtained in compliance with Article 1, Section 9. And I guess that's a double negative there, but you can play with it that way, too, to say, in a positive say, it shall be admissible, notwithstanding that it was not obtained in compliance.
Why do we have to keep talking about Section 9?
Well, you don't have to, Chairman Mannix. The idea here, I think, always has been the search and seizure provisions. But under Article 1, Section 12, there are confession provisions that the Oregon Constitution has construed more narrowly than the comparable provisions of the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, so it would be possible to not tie it specifically to Article 1, to Section 9, but to this article, for example. But I think the idea would be that evidence should be admitted even if it was obtained in violation of some provision of Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, if it would be admissible under the federal Constitution. Now, I think that if it would be admissible under the federal Constitution is adequately addressed in subsection 2 of the same provision, because it says nothing in this section reduces a criminal defendant's rights under the Constitution of the United States, which probably is surplusage under the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution anyway, because that would be implied. But this specifically says that a defendant would be entitled to suppression of evidence if it was obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment, and the exclusionary rule under the Fourth Amendment required exclusion. And so I think that it is not really necessary in subsection 1 to put in language to the effect that if it would be admissible in federal court or if it would be admissible under the United States Constitution, because that thought already is adequately conveyed in subsection 2.
How about evidence that would be admissible in a criminal case under the United States Constitution is not excluded from admission in a criminal case involving a victim in state court as to section 9 of this article?
Well, again,
starting out with, in regard to protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, evidence that that would be admissible in a criminal case under the United States Constitution is not excluded from admission in a criminal case involving a victim in state court as to contentions that it violates Section 9 of this article, something along those lines.
Chairman Mannix, that would, again, appear to be roughly a restating of what is in 89B18. And the reason I was suggesting that it might be best to avoid that what would be admissible under the United States Constitution is because that particular language gives a basis for arguing that it's a revision clause problem, and that the idea that the evidence would be admissible under the United States Constitution, I think, is adequately conveyed in subsection 2 of H.J.R. 91, insofar as it says, well, if the evidence would be suppressible under the Fourth Amendment, it still has to be suppressed.
Well, what about saying the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule as applied in criminal cases under the United States Constitution also applies as to the admission of evidence subject to Section 9, something like that?
Well, Chairman Mannix, again, and this is perhaps a fine or perhaps too fine or the sort of distinction that would trouble only a lawyer, but I think what the Supreme Court of the State of California said in the case is escaping me right now. What they said is insofar if the initiative purports to require the state Supreme Court to construe a state constitutional provision by reference to the way the United States Supreme Court has construed a federal constitutional provision, what you're essentially doing is precluding the state Supreme Court from adopting an independent interpretation of the state constitution, and therefore is a fundamental change in governmental structure and constitutes a revision. And I think what the court said was, it's within the people's prerogative to eliminate entirely an exclusionary rule or a constitutional provision. They could, for example, repeal Article 1, Section 9 entirely. But so long as Article 1, Section 9 is there, the state Supreme Court has to have essentially free reign to interpret it, and it
we could be straightforward and say there shall be no exclusionary rule to be independently applied in the state of Oregon in criminal cases involving a victim as to Section 9 of this article.
Which is, I think, precisely what we tried to do in H.J.R. 91. Just a straightforward elimination of the exclusionary rule or the restriction of the exclusionary rule.
So Mr. Horton, did you notice what I just said, or did Mr. McDonald, did you pick up on that?
Yes.
I'd suggest, of course, this is a little bit of helpful colloquy for the record, but a straightforward intent would be to say that we don't have a separate exclusionary rule as to Section 9 in criminal cases involving a victim, period. And, I mean, we'd use the other language, we'd define victim, et cetera, but just get to that point, then people know what the issue is.
Mr. Chair, Pete Shepard, for the record, that's the concept, at least, that we tried to capture in the work that we did in H.R. 91.
But I'm just thinking if we're just more straightforward about it and just say that we don't have a separate exclusionary rule under Section 9 of this article as to evidence, the admissibility of evidence in a criminal case involving a victim, period. Okay, well, I think we'll need to concentrate on that. Do other members of the panel have any questions or comments they want to offer at this time? Senator Bryan?
A couple of comments. It would seem if we go down this road, then we are further confusing or complicating the issue on search and seizure, because you have search and seizure rules for victim crimes and search and seizure rules for victimless crimes. Is that correct?
Well, Senator Bryan, Mark McDonald again. I think you would always have the same rules under Oregon, Article 1, Section 9. The remedy would be different depending upon whether or not it was a victim or victimless crime.
And if it appeared to be a victimless crime, the evidence would be excluded.
Correct.
So one of the issues that could happen, this is just a collateral effect, would be you try to phrase it in a way that there's always a victim.
Well, I think getting Senator Bryant, Mark McDonald again, getting back to answer the question raised by Mr. Shepard, I think it depends upon how you define crime or offense or criminal prosecution. If it's crime, I would say it's offense specific. It has to have a victim in the case. It have to be a murder, rape, assault, kidnapping, it would be, under this language, a burglary, somebody whose car was stolen, that would be a crime involving a victim. And you would have a different remedy. If there was not a crime committed against a person, I think the criminal code delineates those very clearly.
So in this case, person would not include a non-human being. It wouldn't include a corporation, LLC, partnership, anything like that?
I do not. My interpretation would not. And it would not involve drug offenses or status offenses such as prostitution. It wouldn't cover weapons offenses, things of that sort. There'd actually have to be a victim alleged in the charging instrument.
If you don't have the exclusionary rule, what is the penalty for violating the search and seizure?
Well, there would still be an exclusionary rule, Senator. It would be, though, by default, it would be the exclusionary rule under the federal constitution.
But under the federal constitution, the court determines this isn't a bad enough screw up, so we'll let the evidence in. What's the penalty? Or is there a penalty?
Well, potentially police officers or others who would violate the Oregon constitutional provision still could be subject to a civil suit.
Is there a specific, and I don't know this, is there a specific statutory right to sue an officer for violating?
I can't answer that. I assume there is because I know of my own personal experience of police officers getting sued all the time, but I don't know specifically that it's on the basis of a violation of the search and seizure provision.
I don't know if there is one.
If I might add, Senator, most of the objections, this measure, these changes would address most of the objections raised by the opponents of the measure, or the open fields situations, or other cases that involved most of the time, typically involve drug offenses. So eliminate most of those objections.
What if we simply said, in cases constituting murder, manslaughter, actually we just say homicide, cases constituting homicide, assault, robbery, kidnapping, rape, sex abuse, you start listing the generic listing of personal crimes. Section 9 of this article does not have a special exclusionary rule, does not have an exclusionary rule that would prevent admission of evidence in a criminal case in the state.
Chairman Mannix, Mark McDonald again, certainly that would be one way that it could be done. It seems to be much cleaner to make the distinction based upon cases involving victim and non-victim, because the criminal code is replete with crimes involving victims, and it's much harder to make a distinction.
I was just thinking of another different approach. What I'll ask you gentlemen to do is if you could have some conversations between now and tomorrow afternoon. I think you see the drift in the B-18 amendments of trying to state things more simply and more positively in language that a person with a high school education might understand, but which would also give guidance to judges in the future when they're trying to understand what they have to do. If you could take a look at those options, if we're able to come up with some language that is satisfactory to the majority of the member senators and the House members, we can move with that. If not, we may have to back up and look at other alternatives.
If I might add, Chairman Mannix, Mark McDonald, looking at this proposal from the Department of Justice, it's not what I would call perfect resolution, but it's certainly under the circumstances, the time restraints that we're dealing with here, and the objections that have been voiced before, that this is certainly something very close to what would be acceptable.
My problem with it is packaging and, to be honest, marketing. And the way, when we say shall not be excluded for the reason that it was obtained in violation of Section 9 of this article, is a flashing red light that, boy, someone did something nasty and bad and we're going to let them get away with it. That's the problem with that kind of language.
I agree, Chairman Mannix, and that's the provision that Mr. Dole and I were speaking with Mr. Shepard and Mr. Sylvester, coming up with language in that regard. But otherwise than that...
Well, why don't we just do a constitutional amendment that says that the ruling in State versus Valdez is reinstituted forevermore, which is 1973, I think. That's the one that says that the Oregon search and seizure provisions have traditionally been interpreted in concert with the federal search and seizure provisions. Of course, we had different judges on the court at the time. Any further questions or comments? Well, we will reconvene tomorrow, and I thank everyone for their patience and consideration. We're adjourned.